Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is Friday, which means it's time for our Week in Review, and we continue coronavirus coverage this week. Governor Baker announced just this afternoon that starting May 6th, face masks will be required for everyone in public.
This requirement applies to all workers and customers of businesses and other organizations that are open to the public. The public's required to wear a face covering at all times in grocery stores, retail stores, or on public transportation.
That surprise announcement comes just days after the governor announced a more anticipated and expected decision. Here's the governor at his press briefing on Tuesday.
We're extending the timeline for all non-essential businesses to keep the physical workplaces and facilities closed to all workers, customers, and the public.
That extension now lasts until at least May 18th. Governor Baker also announced this week a 17-member advisory board that will draft a reopening plan for him.
When the data suggests that COVID-19 is diminishing, we'll want to have that plan ready to start recovering the economic ground that we've given up during this fight.
The goal? Strike a tough balance between addressing economic concerns and maintaining public health and safety.
We really have to think about how do we make sure we prepare so we don't have a second surge when we do start to send industry back to people back to work.
Meanwhile, believe it or not, there is still a presidential campaign going on. And former Vice President Joe Biden confronts allegations of sexual assault made by a former staff member.
No, it is not true. I'm saying unequivocally, it never happened. And it didn't. It never happened.
So all of that, but we want to start by checking in on how Massachusetts handled the surge these last few weeks. Let's start here.
April, obviously, was a very long and very hard month, preceded by the month of March, which many people felt the same way about.
So we want to bring our Week in Review panel in to talk about it all. Marie St. Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications, as well as the CEO of a cannabis company. Marie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always good to be with you, Tiziana.
And also here with us is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Tom, thanks for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And you, listeners, you're always a part of our Week in Review. What are you reacting to this week? What did you think about those cuts, the new announcements from the governor, and where we stand in the coronavirus pandemic in this state? Call us. We want you to join us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Tom and Marie, I think the governor put it pretty perfectly there. It has been a tough couple of months, and we're still living in this surge. On Wednesday, we saw the highest single-day death toll from COVID-19, which was 252 people. And so, you know, let me just ask you both, how are you, and how have these last couple of weeks been for you both?
I'll begin. I'm fine. I actually have two children who both have COVID-19.
Oh, Tom.
And they're fine. This okay. is, you know, we hear about the cases with people who are asymptomatic, and one of the daughters literally had nothing. Her boyfriend had it pretty severely, but not with any breathing issues. And my youngest daughter lost her sense of taste for about a week and now is back and otherwise fine.
Is that how both of them knew and were able to get tested, one through sort of contact tracing, essentially, and the other through some very specific symptom, Tom?
Right. The younger one actually was tested because she works at a health and that's where she got it. And the older one lives in New York, and so she got it because it's New York.
Yeah, yeah. So, Marie, how are you these last couple of weeks?
I'm fine, thank God. I think we've been very blessed in my family. I think everyone is healthy. All the kids are healthy. And so I'm very grateful for that. My condolences and my heart goes out to many of my neighbors and friends here in the greater Boston area, particularly in Dorchester, Roxbury, and Mattapan. I've had a number of calls from people who've lost folks. And so this actually has had some tragic ending for many families in Boston. And so I'm just grateful to be able to tell you that my family's fine.
I'm glad to hear that. And Tom, I'm glad that both of your kids are going to be okay in this. You know, the governor has showed some real frustration in his daily press briefings over the last couple of weeks because we have truly plateaued in terms of hospitalizations. Today, he said the last 3 days have showed slight decline, but even as of yesterday, he was saying we're flat for pretty much the last 15 days. And that's a key marker. At the same time, we've got about 50% of the beds in the state open and available. So let me ask you, what do you make of how Massachusetts has handled this crisis and especially this surge?
So I think we've handled it pretty well. The whole idea behind social distancing and the stay-at-home request was that what you would do is flatten the curve. And we clearly flattened the curve. The whole idea was that we did not want to have more hospitalizations than we had hospital beds. And I think we have succeeded in doing that. I think it is a clear puzzle as to why the curve has plateaued rather than going on the downside of the bell. And that is really confounding. And the other thing that's confounding, quite frankly, is if you look at the projections for state-by-state projections for the number of fatalities for each one of the 50 states, Massachusetts on a per capita basis is going to come in number two in the nation, number one being New York. And that's also a puzzle. Why the dramatic difference among the states?
Marie, anything you want to add?
No, I'm in agreement. I'm in agreement. I think that this has been handled very well. I think that it was taken seriously. They relied on the science, which is critical. And I'm glad that we have more beds available than us trying to figure out how to find, hospital beds for those who are in need. And that we're not living through the horrific pictures of refrigerator trucks pulling up at hospitals, as we saw in New York, and taking bodies. So I think that I'm really grateful that it has been tough on business, but I think the priority has to be about saving lives, and that has been and that is working out. But the reality is, we still have over 3,000 patients who are in hospital because of COVID. And right. I think it was the other day we've had over 200 plus of our own citizens here in the state who've passed away. And so it's you multiply that by family. If you want to do contact tracing and think about the impact of that on community and family, I think it's quite significant. So we still have a long way to go.
So let's stay on contact tracing for a minute since you brought it up, Marie. Governor Baker spent multiple press briefings asking people to cooperate if they get a call. Also, he's had talks with Google and Apple about using the apps to track GPS. We have heard some stories in the news about Google and Apple making that available to people voluntarily. But Baker does say he doesn't want to lose people's trust. Do you guys have privacy concerns around approaches to contact tracing, especially as, you know, when we're 3, 4, 5 months further into this and still doing that kind of work?
I think anytime the government is following you around is reason to be concerned. And I think if there is a history of it not being very favorable to certain segments of our community, there's reasons to be concerned. But we have to balance that, right? There is a public health issue at hand. I think I'd love to understand more about how Google and the rest of them will be using the information. We've been doing contact tracing for viruses and other public health issues in Massachusetts for a while, being, you know, we're one of the first, you know, city of Boston being one of the first public health commissions in the country. So, but it's usually been done by human beings, and there's been a level of at least feeling that there is some security in those conversations, and it's usually by someone trusted in the community from the public health sphere. So I am concerned about how this is being executed with this new technology, and would love to understand more.
Tom, yeah, Keene, how about that?
I might note that anyone who uses Facebook is already involved in contact tracing, right? I mean, and the difference, I suppose, is that here would be the government as opposed to a private organization. It actually seems to me that if we're having the government do the contact tracing, we should be able to have more transparency imposed upon the government than, quite frankly, occurs with Facebook and the like. I'd also note that we'd have a limited number of choices out here. So until a vaccine is invented, or until we have herd immunity, the only way that you can really have society kind of reemerge from the lockdown is to, in fact, kind of reverse things. And rather than saying that everyone's potentially carrier, used to identify the people who are most likely to be carriers and then allow the rest of the economy, the rest, everybody else to kind of go back to work or go back to their jobs. So it's almost as if we don't have a choice at this point.
Let's turn to some calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation on our Week in Review this week and everything that has happened this week around coronavirus, shutdown, masks, et cetera, here in the Commonwealth, we've got John on the line from Framingham. John, go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon, Tom and Marie. My name is John. I work as a personal care attendant for a good friend of mine that I've known for over 40 years. And I realize the governor is trying to do his utmost best in regards to the face mask. I wish it was instituted much earlier. But what I was more concerned about, which tended to bother me, the social distance of people not keeping that six-foot distance, you know. So I said to myself, when it was a small child, I was watching TV and I saw the Three Stooges and I saw them with these placards, one on the back and one on the front. I said, you know something? I'm going to make one of these placards. I made one. I took two Ziploc gallon-sized bags. I took and placed two of these plain pieces of paper and then large letterings. I said, keep back 6 feet. I put one in the front. I put one in the back. And I think that's what the people have to realize, that we need to keep our distance right at this point. And it seemed to
John,
work
when you
somewhat.
Say you put one on the front and one on the back, of what? Of you, your body, or your
yes,
car?
Yes. I took two Ziploc gallon-sized bags, and then I placed inside of it, you know, a plain piece of paper, which I put in big red lettering, keep back 6 feet. Then I attached with some jute, garden jute string behind the placard of the Ziploc bag, and I made one for the front, and it was as if like it was a big jewelry piece, and I placed it so you could see it almost up into your chest region. And I also made a second placard, same thing, with the Ziploc bag, and put one in the back. So the people at least could see front and back to realize this is what we need to do, because they just don't get it.
All right. So, John, let's turn that to Marie and Tom, this idea that constant communication, we hear the governor talk about social distancing all the time, and yet we hear the governor and Mayor Walsh also saying all the time, some people just aren't getting it. John put signs on his body.
I mean, I think what John is trying to do is impress upon people the importance of the social distancing and communicating it in his way. And I think that's important. And I'm grateful that a citizen has taken that responsibility. I think it's good to hear it from the governor. It's good to hear it from the mayor. But I think that other civic organizations must stand up and talk about this more broadly, the social distancing piece, because different audiences hear it differently. And respond differently to all of it. So I think the more of us who take it on as a personal responsibility to encourage our fellow citizens to observe the social distancing in order to protect ourselves and our family members, I think is critical. I think social media has been very active. And I agree that can be very helpful there. But I do think I'd love to hear more amplified voices from other trusted leaders to speak about that.
And Tom Keem, just riffing off of that, do you think the governor's choice today to change the mask usage from an advisory to an order is going to make people pay even more attention? Will people take it more seriously now?
So it's a really great question, because what I'm picking up is that people are having lockdown fatigue. And even as the state is kind of continuing to try to escalate the measures it is taking, people are getting very frustrated with the fact that for the month and a half now, they've been inside four walls and not able to go out. They haven't been able to see their friends. The kids haven't been able to get educated. A quarter of the workforce is out of work. And yes, maybe this does something, but I really think that until people see from the governor and from the state that there really is a light at the end of this tunnel, and that there's some defined period here, not a deadline that keeps changing seemingly every week. And I don't think any of us really believe that May 18th is going to be the deadline where we loosen restrictions. I think until there really is something solid out there, you may actually see people increasingly frustrated with this, increasingly angry about it, and pushing back very hard.
You know, in such a tension, Tom, because, I mean, even as we say that, 23 employees at a Walmart in Worcester have tested positive. And an inspection on Tuesday by the Worcester Department of Public Health found no face masks were being used, despite a city order requiring them. Mary Lou Sutter says they aren't sure whether they'll need to test all 400 employees before reopening the store. Here she is.
We're working with UMass about whether to test all 400 employees before they reopen or not. It's obviously a massive testing.
So, yes, fatigue, and I'm sure we've got callers who are going to want to talk about that, but at the same time, we're still seeing massive infection rates. We're in the middle of this right now.
I think it's our collective responsibility. While we may put our elected leaders up front as the people who have to speak to it, I think others have to join the chorus. And I also think the folks who are running our so-called captains of industry need to be involved. I mean, that's totally irresponsible for Walmart not to provide its frontline staff with protection. I mean that's basic. I mean, they are actually helping you maintain your bottom line. So you should protect them. I give kudos to the people of Massachusetts. I think they actually have been observed the social distancing more than we're seeing as we read and watch different media outlets about what's happening in other parts of the country. So I salute them for that. And I think what we have to do is to encourage people. We they don't know. I wish they did know. We all wish we had a definite end date, that we could say Corona is over. Now, everybody, let's just go back to normal. But the problem is we are dealing with an enemy that we have not much information about. They're working feverishly to figure it out. And so I think what we have to do responsibly is to encourage people, as difficult as it is, you're not in a war zone, right? We're still able to get our garbage picked up. We have to think about the good things that we still have, and because we have a working and functioning democracy. You're still able to get clean water. You're still able to get to the hospital. And I know that many people are suffering because it's tough to access food. They're looking at the end of the month to figure out how they're going to pay rent. There's some real hard issues people are facing. And so I think that's where government has to continue to step up and see how they're going to have to mitigate some of those. But I guess on my end, what I could say is, until we know a little bit more, and I trust Dr. Fauci when I hear him talk about how feverishly they're working. I trust a lot of our frontline workers who are, taking those tests, trying to get the results back to us, and they're putting their lives at risk in order to do that for us every day. I think we need to continue to think about others who are on the front line trying to fix this for us so that our families could be safe. And that's all we can do on our end.
Let's grab one more call. Yeah, let's grab one more call on this before we go to a break. We've got David on the line from Lexington. David, go ahead.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi.
You were wondering about why we have the second highest death rate. Three reasons. One, we had the very early inoculation from the Biogen conference. Two, we're a major national and international hub, so people are in and out a lot. And three, we're the third most densely populated state in the union.
So those are great points, David. And I think it was Tom Keene who'd been asking about that. Tom.
Yeah. So the death rate is the rate per million or the death rate per thousand. We certainly are a densely populated state, but there's many other states that are also densely populated and that have major cities with dramatically lower death rates. And to me, it just continues to be a puzzle. I mean, our death rate, our projected death rate, is going to be almost four times greater than the nation as a whole. And meanwhile, you have a state like, you know, Washington or Colorado that's going to be well less than the national average. In kind of getting back to the other question, you know, that was being raised about the pushback, you know, I agree that Massachusetts has embarked upon a particular course of action. And in the face of uncertainty, I guess we have to stay the course to see what happens. It is interesting, and I think after this is all over, there'll be a lot of real analysis about what was the right thing to do, because we certainly are seeing other states and other countries that are doing dramatically different in terms of their activities. Australia and New Zealand, for example, very different attitudes. New Zealand clamped down very heavily. Australia did not. They're going to emerge with about the same death rate. And so I think there's going to be a lot that we will learn from this. And I think that's probably good, because one of the things I think we now know is that this won't be the last pandemic, that we've been warned by epidemiologists for years that this was a possibility. We've seen a few things with SARS, for example, but they never really made it to our shores. But there will be more of them eventually. And we will now, I hope, for the next one, have a better understanding of what we need to do and do it early.
We're going to shift our attention to the reopening. What does it take to reopen? What are we going to have to in place? Can you hang in till then? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I know Marie's got a note she wants to pick up from before the break, but before we do that, we do have one caller on this who's been hanging on since the beginning of the show. So let me get him in real quick. We've got Dave from Millennium Park. Dave, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Listen, first of all, I don't think he's done a great job. Ask the thousands of people who've died in nursing homes how he's done.
Who, Dave?
The governor, excuse me, and the governor.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe if we'd spent a little bit more time on the nursing homes and less time on building field hospitals, that number would have been a lot less. But that, as that aside, Tom, I agree with you. This cannot be open-ended. This cannot go into June. The society itself cannot tolerate it. Financially, we can't tolerate it. And if the numbers don't move, then we're going to have to figure out something else. As you said, there are other ways of doing this. We seem to be on this one course only. Nobody seems to challenge the governor or the mayor saying that this is the only way, when there might be other ways of doing things. And if it keeps going on this way, because you're right, the 18th comes along, nothing's going to change. Maybe a few tweaks. Maybe they'll let the golfers finally golf. But that's about it. You know, real change into June, July? Can we really do that into then? August? I don't,
Dave,
think so.
I really appreciate that call, Dave. And I hear Dave's frustration there, and I think he's voicing a frustration from a lot of people. So, Marie, let me let you start with some response there.
Yeah, and I think there is a lot of frustration out there, and I think particularly, and there are some communities that have been particularly impacted. And I want to say I agree. I think there was a gentleman at the top that talked about gave three different reasons why Massachusetts was most impacted. But we also have to look at the disparities in Massachusetts as well, because if we look at who's dying, it's the elderly, communities of color, and poor communities. That's where you have finding the highest level of death and the highest level of folks who are being tested as being positive for COVID. So I do think that as you shift into this, how do we reopen, the issue of equity has to be really placed at the center of this conversation, because if we build it the same way, then we're just, the next time we have this problem, we're going to quadruple the deaths. And not because we don't know, we know and we chosen to ignore it. So I hear the frustration. And yeah, we've had some deaths. Any death is unacceptable. But we also have to take a look at the root cause of some of those deaths and shift the system so that the people who are actually out there at the front line doing those work, why did these people die? The frontline workers, many of them did not have the appropriate protection. Today, we're saying, and who do we define as frontline? Yes, it's the medical people. Yes, it's the doctors. Yes, it's the nurses. But it's also the person who's cleaning that that space, that those contaminated spaces. It's also your bus drivers. It's also the people working in the nursing homes, the home care, the home care provider who's going in to help and assist those who are disabled and elderly, and they need protection too. And unfortunately, many of them are still not getting access to that. So those are real issues that we need to continue to work on before we think about how we just move to a full-blown opening.
So Tom Keene, Marie introduced some additional threads there to the point that Dave from Millennial Park made at the beginning of this segment. Let me give you a chance to react to all of that or any of that.
So, I mean, I certainly agree in terms of understanding the frontline workers. As I mentioned at the top of the show, one of my daughters got it because she works in a long-term care facility, and that facility has COVID-19. She, as a consequence, got the disease that way. So I'm very sympathetic to that notion. But to kind of go from Dave's point and about reopening, there's really two points here. One is that we have been very focused upon deaths from COVID-19, but not, I think, as focused upon the cost of what we're doing to prevent those deaths. And I don't mean just this simple formulation of profits versus people. I actually think it's people versus people. I think, for example, the fact that we have shut down our schools and we're not delivering a quality education, believe me, via online, is going to have a very serious long-term cost for a whole generation of people, one that we have yet to begin to calculate. And I think that's one point. The second, in terms of kind of coming back and reopening the economy, is there's no question that as we reopen the economy, you are going to see the number of cases climb again. That's the whole notion here, that you reopen, people will be in contact with each other. The trick is not that we won't have cases of COVID. The trick is to make sure that we keep the number of cases below our availability of resources to care for those people. And that's going to be the hard task that's going to face us over the summer and into the fall. You know, unless Donald Trump's right and there's magic lights that can kill the whole thing, but I don't think he is.
So I want to pick up a couple of calls back to back here to add into this conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's start with Deborah in Wayland. Deborah, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just heard the order from Governor Baker, and I'm very concerned about the following. As I understand it, it's that everyone is to wear a mask if, underlined, they can't socially distance. What I'm saying is that there is a widespread issue with people being able to maintain 6 feet, and I don't think 6 feet was just pulled out of thin air. I mean, I think it's based on research, but people can't seem to get it, and they drift. And so they'll say, okay, I'm not wearing a mask, I'll socially distance, and they don't. If everybody was wearing a mask as a sign of solidarity and respect and courtesy, then I think that that would really help dealing with people that really can't seem to get and maintain the 6 foot distance problem.
Deborah, thanks for that call. And I think Adam from Somerville has something similar on his mind. Adam, are you there?
Yes, I'll pick up right where Deborah left off. I am in Somerville, where there has been a mask law in place for a little bit longer, and it's explicit.
And a fine in place, right?
That's right, set to take effect this coming week. But it includes parks, it includes sidewalks, and it's more comprehensive than the statewide announcement. So I'm on a walk right now, and I can tell you that maybe 50%, maybe 60% of the several hundred people I've seen are wearing masks. I've talked to some of them about it, and the responses I've gotten have been sort of, we don't care, or indicating that they're not taking it seriously, or that they don't think anybody's going to stop them or fine them, and there will be no consequences for their own actions. And I will say that this corroborates with even my own housemates and neighbors have masks, but sometimes just don't feel like wearing them. And one of my housemates said, yeah, if we want them to change their behavior, we have to figure out a way to get them fined, which is obviously troubling. But so we're learning that many people won't act unless they're personally impacted. And so how do we think about understanding the consequences as they affect people personally while centering equity and not lurching towards incarceration and punishing communities who are already the most impacted in this and other crises?
So these are great questions that Adam's raising and concerns that Deborah is raising. And, you know, Governor Baker was very clear in the press conference today. I really listened for this, that he's putting this mask order in place because he believes this is a long-term condition for the Commonwealth, that in order for the government to reopen our economy the way we want to, this kind of mask, disciplined mask practice will be essential. So what of it, Marie?
You know, honestly, I think we're all in unknown territory, and I can, from my chair, armchair, can give all sorts of opinions. But at the end of the day, I have to rely on the medical and research experts, rely on their advice and act. So that's one. So I think that government has to put that information out there and use that as the basis of their planning. Second, people are used to being able to do, we're in a society where we're used to be able to do what we want when we want. So asking for significant behavior change on a dime is not going to happen. I think Massachusetts has behaved rather well. And so we have to continue to push the message out to help people in shifting that behavior. And I want to agree with the caller, because I don't think making this into a criminal issue, that particular population who will be most impacted is already being most impacted, right? They're already dying more. They're already more under receiving less education, even when things were normal. So all I'm saying is it takes time. I get the frustration, but I don't have an answer. And I don't know any of us have an answer to provide the public. We're just saying they need to come up with an answer. And what they're saying is we're listening to the advice of the experts, and this is what we're doing. So I think let's try to be patient a little longer, because at the end of the day, in the calculus that was made, we're going to open up, right? And when we open up, we have to do it in a measured way based upon evidence. And then what we're saying is that some folks are going to be expendable. And when we open this economy, understand that some folks are going to be expendable. We've already made a judgment on who's expendable already in some ways in our economy. Now we're going to see further evidence of that. And so the question about that is, how will we limit the numbers of people that society has decided are expendable? Because you don't get to come back once you die.
So that's a stark point, Marie, and one very well made there. The other thing that I feel like we're hearing from those calls, and it's a tension I want to talk a little more about too, is this tension between civil liberties and enforcement. And Tom Keene, I'm gonna bring some sound in here. Some states have started to reopen. I want to ask you about one that hasn't. In Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has extended her stay-at-home order until May 28th. It was set to expire last night. And an armed militia stormed the state house in Michigan. Truth in Advertising, I was born and raised in Michigan, demanding to be let in as a vote was supposed to be happening. And here's a little bit of what that sounded like. And let's just be clear, some of the protesters were armed with masks, camouflage, armed rifles, and other firearms as they were confronting state police in the lobby. So here we have Marie saying, we've already made a choice about who's vulnerable, who we're going to allow to be on the front lines of grocery stores and cleaning. And at the same time, do we face a specter of this level of resistance to enforcement of basic things like masks and stay-at-home orders? How do we manage that?
So, obviously, I'm not going to support people going around with guns and trying to do something like this. But I think what the clip that you played is obviously part of what we've been talking about in terms of a backlash, that there are a lot of people who really feel that that the lockdown has gone for too long. And I think the other thing you're seeing is that while we have a national policy in place, Michigan, truthfully, has one of the lower rates of a lower rate of infection. And I think that actually is kind of playing into some of this. And then, of course, if you look at other parts of Michigan, you'll see maybe Detroit is very seriously impacted, but some of the more rural or suburban areas are not going to have anywhere near the same level of impact. And that's also true within Massachusetts and certainly every state. I do think that this kind of resistance or this type of backlash is going to continue. until there can be some solid plans put in place and people really see that light at the end of the tunnel.
I want to get another couple of calls in here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we've got Catherine on the line from Fenway.
Hello.
Hi, Catherine.
Hey. So I just had a little comment in regards to some of the mask stuff that's happening. One of the issues that I think is part of the problem is that in this narrative, a lot of what we're hearing is that the people that are at greatest risk are older. So I think a lot of what you're seeing in walking around Boston with people being not necessarily concerned about social distancing has to do with some ableism. You know, someone's not going to be able to look from a distance and see someone who appears to be young and healthy and know whether that person has asthma or diabetes or an immune deficiency. And I think people are kind of ignorant of that, as opposed to maybe if they see someone who's older, they're a little more considerate. And as we start to open the economy again, I worry about those people having to go back to work and what we're going to do to take care of people that are at a greater risk, even though they might not fit into a category that we're being told is more vulnerable.
Catherine, thanks for that call. I want to add one more caller in here. Let's hear from Jack in Acton.
Hi. I wanted to address a couple of points made by Tom. First is the notion of what are acceptable levels of death. The World Health Organization has put out a list of, I think, 7 criteria, which a community or state or country should meet before they consider reopening their economies. And that isn't just to meet the notion that Tom introduced, that we have to be able to avoid a surge so big it swamps the healthcare system. That's far too low a standard. The real standard is minimizing the number of deaths. If you can get it down to, you know, 7 a day instead of 2,300 a day, you're doing great, right? That's the idea. So I would push for that. The other question is whether or not we can tolerate reopening as people get sick. I mean, there are people on right-wing media who tout the fact that it seems to be mostly the old and infirm who would be killed by this, and that seems to be, for them, somewhat okay and tolerable. The kids won't get it. Well, the kids transmit it. If they do get it, they transmit it. Some kids have died. They had compromised immune systems or some other factor, but it does kill kids. So we shouldn't be naive about the dangers of this. One of the things COVID-19
Thanks, Jack. Jack, I'm going to take it back from you there just because I'm on a hard clock for this next break and I want to get a little time in for Marie and Tom to respond. Marie and Tom, I've got about 2 minutes left before we have to go to a break. So let me give you each just a quick chance to respond. Marie, you first. Or Tom. Tom, go.
Let me just address the mask thing first. I'm a little concerned about the governor's order because of its either or quality, that you can be either 6 feet away or wear a mask, which suggests that you can be wear a mask and not worry about social distancing. That's the implication of that. And everything I've seen in terms of masks is that if you've got a fresh N95 mask, which are the surgical quality masks, they do indeed work. But the masks that we're talking about that most people are wearing are essentially the scarves left over from the winter. And those are clearly not as effective as social distancing. So I am really wondering whether or not we're actually going back a little by trying to say a mask is okay, social distancing no longer necessary.
And how about you, Marie? What's your reaction?
I guess I would say we need both the mask and social distancing. I think when you're in this condition, sometimes just clear, more definitive direction is more helpful than the choice. But the bottom line is we don't have enough just regular non-surgical masks available for regular people who are actually out there working every day. And so we have a PPE issue still in some areas, and we need to deal with it. As it relates to the distancing and the masks, this new order, it can't simply be, I'm going to say it again, it cannot simply be a government voice. It's got to be all of us talking to our neighbors and really imposing, telling them why this is so important, and then really differentiating the message, because it's not simply old people older people and dying. Young people are dying as well and are getting contaminated. So there's a messaging issue here that we need to work on.
And we want to finish our Week in Review this week with our hubbubs. Those are those local stories or events that caught our attention this week and brought us some inspiration. Seems really important right now to make sure we leave time for those. So Marie St. Fleur is still with us, former Massachusetts State Representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie, what's your hubbub this week?
Honestly, it's just to say thank you to all the frontline workers who continue to provide support for all of us so that we can be home safely. And my challenge to the reopening committee that the governor has pulled together is embed equity in all of this, because childcare workers are critical to anybody going back to work. And so hopefully they'll be part of the conversation and how we're going to build a system or reopen with an eye towards a system that works better for the 800,000, I believe that's how many workers that we have that are frontline workers in Massachusetts who need us to build a better economy that is more inclusive, that they're at the front line in the conversation of the conversation in this reopening as well.
Fantastic. And Tom Keene is also still with us, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Tom, what do you have for us this week?
Well, we spent the entire show talking about the pandemic. And as awful as it has been, at least we know it's going to have an end. Maybe this fall, maybe once a vaccine has been developed. But the global climate crisis continues unabated. Or the question is, does it? A report out yesterday from the International Energy Agency projects that carbon dioxide emissions will drop 8% this year. Carbon dioxide, of course, is the main culprit behind global warming. Cause of the drop, not surprisingly, is the worldwide lockdown from the coronavirus. Just look at the roads around Boston. Traffic jams here are a thing of the past. The drop doesn't mean the climate crisis is over, however, but it may give us a little more time. The big question about this silver lining: after the pandemic, do we just bounce back to the bad old ways, or do we perhaps use the viral crisis as a means to forge a cure for the planet itself?
Fantastic. And let me just give you, we've actually managed our time very well. So let me give you a chance to respond to each other's hubbubs just briefly. Any thoughts from either of you based on what you heard from the other?
Well, the notion of the frontline workers is very present in everyone's mind. I mean, if you think about the people who are lucky enough to work from home, let's face it, for the most part, highly educated, white collar jobs, and the people on the front lines are actually probably the least well paid in our society. They're the ones who really often are working double shifts. So to really Marie's point about equity is really true here, which is we are putting the people most at risk who actually are rewarded least for their efforts.
Excellent. And Marie, in 30 seconds or so, your reaction to Tom's climate message?
And I agree with Tom and his climate message. We've got to get it right. Otherwise, it's not going to matter if there's another pandemic, if we don't make certain that there's an earth for us to live in.
Before I go to my hubbub, I'm going to say goodbye to Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts State Representative, and Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor. I appreciate you both joining us on Week in Review today. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tatiana.
All right, so we wanted to play with sound on my hubbub a little bit, so I'm going to go next. Last week, the Massachusetts Health Council announced the winner for its video contest to promote social distancing practices among youth. I had seen the announcement of the contest a little while back and was intrigued by it. So the contest was open to middle and high school students around the state, and they were invited to use multiple social media platforms to send in their videos and their messages that would reinforce social distancing and other safe practices. While they announced their winner, and the winner got $500. The video and content are really good, so shout out to the grand prize winner, which is Malia Flores, who's an 11th grader from Boston. Also, second place went to two students from Lexington and a third to a student in Randolph. And I think we are going to give you guys a little bit of sound from Malia Flores, 11th grader from Boston's grand prize winning video.
Wash your hands, please. Don't spread germs. Remember to follow all these terms. Okay. Cough in a tissue or your inner elbow. There's still a few things that you should know. If you feel sick, please stay home instead of letting those germs roam. If you need to touch your lips, nose, or eyes, wash your hands before you try. Stay 6 feet away from others. Too many cases you don't want another. This will slowly feed your friends. Stay inside Corona.
Malia, that was fantastic. Loved having it. Thanks so much. Glad to give that hubbub today. And we're going to kind of transition now, because we are living in this new world, which I've been talking about it all day today. And so many of us are working from home and isolating to protect ourselves and our loved ones. But it means we're separated from the people that we work with and that we care about. And that's true for us here on the Radio Boston team, too. So we have been bringing you some little moments to show you what we're doing to stay connected as a team and telling stories of how we're passing the time. Today, we've got Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman now in studio. Yes, Walt?
I'm here, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm well, Walt. What's going on?
Well, I'm sitting in your chair, which is a little weird. It's still here, if not a little dusty, but you know, we're holding it open for you.
Thank you. Does it feel a little odd to be on that site? So, Walt, you're going in a couple of hours every day, right? You're not exclusively quarantined at home.
No, I'm coming into the stations in the afternoon. I'm helping produce this show from inside the studio. So as long as you're not really hearing about me on air, that means I'm doing my job. You know, we're playing the sound for you. We're getting the music up and down. We're getting all these wonderful callers on air. But today I'm here to tell you a little bit what I'm doing when I'm at home.
Tell me, you have a very specific story you want to reflect on.
Yeah, we were talking about this morning, Tiziana, because we're all looking for stuff to fill our time, all of this new aimless, structureless time that we all have. And, I've been Zoom calling my parents, Zoom calling my friends, kind of the normal things. But I recently got really into this puzzle. And I know you're kind of a puzzle master, but I
enjoy puzzles.
You do like 2,000 piece puzzles, and I'm not there.
Not alone.
But my roommates and I were doing this 1,000 piece puzzle of Monet's water lilies, which, if you can picture it, it's basically two colors. It's green and blue, and there's like a tiny bit of pink. But I've gotten, I don't know, I've never done puzzles before. It's been so daunting. You stare at this box of one color and you think, how can this ever be a picture? And it's just sort of fun to come up with these strategies. You know, you find the edge pieces, you make the edge pieces, then you think, okay, this top left corner is a little lighter blue. So I'm going to go into the box, I'm going to find all the little light blues and start connecting them. And as these hours pass and you're spending time with your friends and these little strategies are taking you further and further into the puzzle, and suddenly this picture is emerging. I just had this aha moment about why people love puzzles. It's like, I don't know, it's like this metaphor for life in this quarantine that we're in, is if you just chip these little pieces away, you're going to get to the full picture. You're going to get to the other side. And it's like the most hokey, cliche thing ever. But I just had this lightning bolt moment with it, and I'm so excited to finish it.
So how far along are you?
I'm like two-thirds done. There's this little strip left of blue and green swampy water lilies that I think we're going to get done maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow. I don't know.
And you said we, and you're referring to your friends, but I think you live in a house with six people, right? So you do have a community working.
We have a community working on it. What, many hands makes light work? Light puzzling?
That's right. That's right. Well, I'm going to invite guests, our listeners, Walt, to think about the metaphor for living in quarantine that you just gave us with that puzzle. You know, a little corner at a time, and you're figuring out the picture as you go along. That's Radio Boston's Walt Wuthman. Thanks for joining us for that, Walt. It was great to hear from you, even from my chair.
Thanks, Tiziana.